You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of June, 2017, on Monocle 24. Live from London, you're tuned in to Midori House. I'm Andrew Tuck. Enough is enough, says the Prime Minister, following the weekend's terrorist attack here in the British capital.
We cannot and must not pretend that things can continue as they are. Things need to change.
Outrage and uncertainty following two deadly eruptions of violence and destruction in just 2 weeks. Meanwhile, London's mayor condemns the use of religion as a justification for terror.
And I'm angry and furious that these three men are seeking to justify their actions by using the faith that I belong to.
With strong words from all sides of politics and an election just days away, we'll assess the long-term ramifications both here in London and abroad on this special edition of Midori House, starting now. So, welcome to Midori House. I'm Andrew Tuck, and my guest today, Brian Klass, fellow in Comparative Politics Department of Government, London School of Economics, and Sebastian Borger, London correspondent for the Berliner Zeitung. Welcome both to the programme. Now, when Britain's Prime Minister addressed a shocked and grieving nation on the steps of No. 10 Downing Street, she was not only seeking to reassure a rattled society, but also set out her own anti-terror manifesto. Enough is enough, the Prime Minister said. Things need to change. Well, following recent attacks in Paris, Nice, Berlin and Manchester, the Prime Minister's warning that things cannot continue as they are is sure to resonate. But such discussions rarely come without fears of eroding democratic values. Brian, we're already trying to look at this in a context to unpack its meaning. And she said, you know, enough is enough. What do you think that can really mean? Because it's very easy to come up with a whole list of things you could potentially do. We've seen in the past, then it becomes very complicated getting them through Parliament. It's not always easy to turn around a society.
That's absolutely true. I think, you know, the enough is enough tagline of that speech was probably secondary to the part she followed up with where she said there needs to be some awkward and embarrassing conversations. And I think this is one of the aspects that I think Theresa May actually is completely right about, is she will have to have, as Prime Minister, as a leader, some very awkward conversations with the British Muslim community about how they can work together to tackle this in a way that doesn't necessarily require legislation. And that's the path forward that is the least likely to damage democratic values. Obviously, there has to be review of intelligence services, et cetera, policing, all of this. But, you know, you'd want to see the first and foremost approach be the one that was the most consensual and the one that was the most, you know, driven by mutual agreement that this cannot go on. And I think that Theresa May was right to point that out, because this is something where it has happened now 3 times in 3 months. And it is not something that can just become the new normal.
Can I just pick you up on that? What's interesting is that in all three of the UK terror attacks, people in the Muslim community have called out these people. We're going to find out the names of the people, it seems, in the coming hours. But, you know, there's reports today that, you know, neighbours, friends phoned the anti-terror hotline and said, this guy is crazy. You need to do something about him. So you can do a lot with the community. But if the community is regularly calling out these people and there are no consequences for them, then surely they're going to tire of doing that. You can't throw that always back on the Muslim community, can you?
No, I think that there's a fine line to be drawn here. I'm not trying to say that the Muslim community is complicit in this. I think that that would be unfair. What I'm trying to say is that with those calls, there's a huge amount of them, right? I mean, this is something where there's a very large volume of people being called in. And some of them, by the way, speaking of democratic values, are surely going to be false alarms where, you know, a racist person is just calling on their Muslim neighbor because they don't like them. So I think, you know, trying to tease out what is an accurate denunciation of somebody in the Muslim community, which leads need to be chased up, et cetera, and who is an actual threat is the difficult part. And that will be part of the intelligence review. I mean, this is the common sense approach. This is done in every counterterror, you know, sort of post-mortem ever, is looking at what they got wrong, what they got right. But I think that, you know, this is something where it's trying to find a needle in a haystack. There are a lot of British Muslims, and you're trying to find people who are actually a genuine threat without any sort of incursion on the rights of people who are not genuine threats to the British population. And that's really the difficult part.
I kind of agree, Sebastian, but when you look at, you know, on the other side of this, you know, you were talking about embarrassing conversations. Whenever it's a kind of, you know, just, you know, a regular white person who does a massacre, we don't call out the white community. We don't call out the Christian community. When, you know, when some years ago a bomb was placed in the Ambrel Duncan pub, a gay pub in central London, nobody called out white straight people for not doing more about, you know, terror in their community.
No.
And I don't you think there's a trap that we imagine that you know, all Muslims are imams and all Muslims are living indeed in a community. Most of the Muslim people I know in London are not part of a community. They go to work like everybody else and they just lead the rather regular lives.
Well, of course. I mean, we've read and heard the wonderful stories of, you know, the Muslim consultant in one of the hospitals, I think King's College, I think it was, who had ended his shift and basically turned round on the night. And we heard the same story in Manchester. No. But look, the people who commit these kind of atrocities are not known to you and me. Let's not beat about the bush. I mean, this is the precariat, we call it in Germany, people who live on the edge of society, who have often no regular jobs, who live off social security. And I mean, needle in the haystack, I don't think fits the bill. We've got very many needles, but I mean, a lot of them are known to the security services. So, and when you talk to Muslims, as I have done since Manchester happened again, and I've done before, there's always the interesting phenomenon that there are lots of self-appointed male community leaders telling you how terrible the society is stacked against them and Islamophobia and all of that. And do try and talk to some women and a very different picture emerges. I mean, the whole controversy about the so-called prevent strategy here in Britain, where the government has over the past few years asked people, not just in the Muslim community, but people in the community, teachers, university lecturers, to have an eye on people who come out with radical statements. And there's been this tremendous uproar of always from the self-appointed community leaders and echoed, unfortunately, by some Labour politicians like Andy Burnham, who is now the mayor of Greater Manchester. Wrong. The prevent strategy has actually worked in the sense that people have not gone to Syria. It's first and foremost about child protection. It's about protecting our children, in this case Muslim children, from doing themselves and others harm.
Can I just say, we've just had some news come up here on the screen that one of the attackers has now been named as Khurram Butt, who is living in Barking, which is a neighbourhood of East London. I'm sure the other names will come out in the coming hours. But Brian, when we look at the embarrassing conversations, what seems to have happened today is that many people feel that, you know, one of the embarrassing conversations she needs to have is with her own team and say, you know, why did we get rid of 20,000 police officers? She's not actually coming out of this wholly unscathed, is she?
No, I mean, this is looking very bad politically for her, and Corbyn is certainly scoring points off this a couple days before the election.
But, well, let's be fair, they're both trying to score points off each other.
Of course, but on the police issue is what I mean. He's obviously making hay of this, right? So, I mean, I think the question, though, and with an obvious answer, is would more police officers really have helped on Saturday night? And I think the answer is clearly no.
That's not the point, Brian, and you know it. The point about more police is that you need to have people neighborhood policing. That has been cut. And you also need to have armed police. That has been cut. Now, on Saturday night, very luckily, we had obviously a station of armed police very close to Borough Market, and therefore they managed to get there and kill these people within 8 minutes, which is great by every standard. I've been a crime reporter. I've been to that kind of experiences with the German police. This is exceptional, but it's an exceptional exception. Let's be clear about that. And you cannot say that the fact that she cut police numbers hasn't affected the police. It has affected the police.
Yeah, I mean, that may well be true. I mean, I think that any time that you make cuts, there's obviously going to be consequences. I'm just trying to say that I think in this situation, obviously more neighborhood policing might be part of the strategy. But I think that this is something where, you know, trying to pin this on one specific cut is probably an unfair characterization.
Yeah, and I think it is hard to know, you know, I think she is in a sticky spot. It's hard to know where those police would have gone. I think you're right. If they're being used for community action further down the line, it would help. Do you think that for her, Sebastian, that there is something difficult here? Because Corbyn actually is in a lucky position, because 20,000 police cut has become such a kind of a known thing and is such an easy number to get hold of. When she starts explaining the nuance of her approach and, you know, what all the different points of enough is enough will mean, it's quite hard for the public to get their head around it. So actually, when they come away from it, all they remember is, yeah, but she cut 20,000 police officers.
She's been the Home Secretary for 6 years and a quarter, and since then she's been the Prime Minister. So there's, you know, she's responsible. And the Tories have got to stop blaming the last Labour government for stuff. This is their responsibility. But I feel like Corbyn has absolutely no credibility whatsoever. Because, you know, he can talk all he likes about, till he gets blue in the face, about cuts in the police. His record on police and anti-terror legislation is absolutely abysmal. Any credible Labour leader, we're coming back to the same point over and over again. Any credible Labour leader would have made mincemeat of her over the last few days and hours. I mean, apart from that, I don't know about you, but I thought it was absolutely terrible for her. 12 hours after the attack, sorry about this, but the bodies were hardly cold, to go out and make political points. She shouldn't have done it. She can talk all she likes about these 4 points, two of which are completely either unworkable or unsubstantial. But she shouldn't have done it on that day, particularly when she at the same time announced that the election campaign was to be interrupted for a day. I think she's come out of this election campaign 7 weeks now. We're hearing these slogans of strong and stable leadership, and she comes out weaker and weaker by the day. And if we had a proper leader of the opposition, we'd have a proper alternative on Thursday. But no, we'll be stuck with this Tory government.
Brian, when you heard her, she was much criticised. Emily Thornhill from the Labour Party said that, you know, she had broken an agreement not to make it into a campaigning issue. And she was out there, you know, naming policies and what she would do. Do you think that she should have held off for a little while?
Well, I mean, I think that they're in an impossible situation. This is obviously one of the core reasons why people are going to vote on Thursday. It's on everyone's mind. The election is coming rapidly, and the terror attack just happened. I mean, I think there's a very fine line to tread, because you have to pay respect to the people who are the victims. You have to be, very much aware of their suffering and not try to sort of score points off it. But I also think that at the end of the day, you know, politicians are there to solve problems, and this is a problem a lot of people care about. So, you know, I think the timing is an issue. I think the question about what would be done is a serious question that needs to be asked, because people are going to have a government for the next several years that is dealing with this as one of the major points. They should be informed before they cast a ballot about what the person they're voting for will plan to do about counterterrorism. Obviously, Theresa May will be judged partly on a record because she's been in office, but I think also, you know, Corbyn may have been fair in criticizing her about police cuts, but he also needs to put forward before Thursday a credible alternative. I mean, I agree completely that he has an abysmal record on this. So he needs to say what he would do differently. And unfortunately, it's very likely, if it's going to be credible, to be at complete odds with his past statements on terrorism. So, you know, this is one of the things where, okay, she maybe should have waited another day. But, you know, I think it would also be a disservice to the democratic process if voters go to the polls on Thursday unaware of what their candidates would do on a major issue that they really care about.
And there are people within his own shadow cabinet who I've heard today say that they still can't kind of countenance the way that he voted. He, of course, claims that he just felt that the measures would be ineffective. But Well, anyway, during Theresa May's speech, she also spoke of the evil ideology of Islamist extremism and vowed to stamp out the safe spaces that allow such beliefs to flourish. There was also a warning for people not to live their lives in lives of separated, segregated communities, and a call for greater emphasis on British values. It contrasted with comments by the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, who issued a sharp rebuke on the use of religion by the terrorists to justify their actions. Let's hear a clip from him.
And I'm angry and furious that these three men are seeking to justify their actions by using the faith that I belong to. The ideology they follow is perverse, it is poisonous, and it has no place in Islam. And I condemn this terrorist act, but also the poisonous ideology these men and others follow.
Well, strong words there, Brian, but it's been interesting. First of all, let's take the US perspective. First of all, he's been hit several times by Donald Trump tweeting that, you know, he was a disgrace, and that he was an apologist for the terrorists because he didn't come out stronger at the beginning and had said to people, just carry on with your lives. And Mr. Trump believes that you couldn't carry on as before. What do you make of the U.S. perspective brought in by Donald Trump?
Well, it's a personal feud. I mean, Sadiq Khan spoke out very clearly against Trump during the campaign. Trump then challenged Sadiq Khan to an IQ test, which was not taken up, but that actually happened. And so, you know, they've had a rivalry. Trump is a guy who does not let rivalries go. He said very clearly in an interview during the campaign he would remember what Sadiq Khan said, and that's showing up right now. So I think, you know, what's to make of this is that Donald Trump is a small man who cannot let it go when somebody insults him. But in the greater political ramifications of this, they're severe. Trump is falsely misquoting Sadiq Khan by saying there's no reason to be alarmed, when the quote was actually there's no reason to be alarmed by the increased police presence over the coming days. It's a very different quote when you have the full context. And it's the responsible thing to say, by the way, to reassure the population after a terror attack. But Trump is making it very politically toxic for British politicians to stand with the U.S. publicly. I mean, I think this is a serious miscalculation that his advisors need to take stock of, because, you know, it's very easy to score points attacking Theresa May about being too cozy with Donald Trump. But every British politician that ends up in 10 Downing Street realizes the immense importance of the transatlantic relationship to security, to all sorts of angles about British prosperity. And so I think, you know, he's making it so difficult for Theresa May to not, you know, distance herself. And that would be a terrible thing for both sides of the Atlantic. So I hope that he stops. But, you know, he tweeted about Sadiq Khan yesterday. He tweeted about him this morning. He can't stop. And, you know, it's just, you imagine Ronald Reagan or George H.W. Bush or George W. Bush, any of the Republican presidents, you know, saying, attacking an elected official of an allied city after a terrorist attack. I mean, it's so ridiculously unbelievable and unpresidential that it's hard to express, you know, the disgust I have for it. But it's just, it is disgusting.
And Sebastian, he ends up hurting the wrong people, because surely Londoners don't want outsiders at this point, especially American presidents, telling them how to feel and react, even if they don't think Sadiq Khan has done a great job, potentially. They don't want somebody outside saying that. So the people that get hurt in this are Londoners, not Sadiq Khan.
I don't think whether people get hurt at all. I think aren't we getting united by Donald Trump? You know, whatever else we think about anybody else in this country or anywhere else in the world, I mean, this is a uniting factor. And actually, someone, I don't know who, floated the idea he might come over this week for a visit, where I thought, oh, yes, let's have that. And then we're all Muslims, Christians, Hindus, whoever. We'll be lining the streets and anyway.
To both of you, maybe start with you, Brian, that it's also interesting, this notion of living in segregated communities. You know, we've never thought that much of a problem about that in the past. You know, we have, you know, gone up to North London and smiled as we drive through Jewish neighbourhoods where there are, you know, very orthodox Jewish communities who don't really want to mix with their non-Jewish neighbours. We've been to Sikh communities where actually most people spend a lot of their time with other Sikh people. We don't mind it. So it's not the segregation that you can't then go to one community and say you can't be, you know, living with your own people. We all do that, don't we?
Yeah, and I think that as a practical point, it's hard to imagine how when people self-select into communities of their own ethnicity or religion, how you'd actually stop that. I mean, and that would be super undemocratic to try, right? I think the point that she's trying to make, which is valid, is that there are dark pockets of certain segments of the community that are not being adequately sort of exposed to alternative viewpoints, or people who are aware of them are not adequately, you know, sort of policing their own community. Now, whether that's true or not in this instance, we'll have to find out, right? And this is something where we're going to find out increasingly as the identities of these attackers become clear. But I do think that there is some truth to the idea that there needs to be more of a push to try to reach out to people who are alienated by society in these isolated pockets and are radicalized. Because it is true that there are a very large number of people who are under consideration as people who are potential radicalized jihadists. And that is untenable. It is simply untenable. I mean, I think that's something that is the hard truth that Theresa May is trying to get at, is that we can't just have an attack every month and something does need to change. The conversation about what needs to change specifically is going to be a very difficult and long one.
And Sebastian, what's also fascinating is, you know, the difficulty of reaching these people, because, you know, again, we're imagining them as a nice cohesive religious group, you know, even if, you know, they are, you know, preaching to the world of fundamentalism. But in fact, many of these young kids are a part of a group of youngsters who get caught up in all sorts of things. They get caught up in smoking skunk and being in gangs and petty crime, and some of them go in that direction, and some of them go towards, you know, fundamentalism if they're in that community. It's difficult to track all those people when actually when you first come across them, probably as teenagers, they're involved in all sorts of things. It's quite hard to pinpoint, okay, this is a danger for a youth becoming radicalized, isn't it?
Very difficult, no doubt about it. I mean, really, we shouldn't, we can't envy the security services and the police who have to deal with it. But deal with it they must, because, and Brian is right, if we start having an attack of this sort every month, then this country will change as it already has, and not to the better. And so it's much better for, and in that sense, I agree. Theresa May is right. I thought her timing was bad, but the point is correct. There are those conversations to be had. You know, if you when you look at Manchester, where I went, and there's a pretty small area of the city of 2 or 3 square kilometers, where I've forgotten the number now, but more than a dozen people have been picked up. Either they went to Syria to fight with IS, or they were convicted of terrorism, or indeed, as we now have, the guy blows himself up, and the brother is arrested. We don't know what his involvement was. But you know, the same is true for a pretty small area of Birmingham. It's in the end not rocket science. It's very difficult, and we know that occasionally someone will slip through. But for example, I fear that we cannot go on letting people who have gone to Syria and have sort of given up their allegiance to this country by declaring allegiance to the caliphate to come back into this country. I can't see it. I'm sorry. That's one of the problems, of course, which we now know about the arena bomber in Manchester, who went with his father to Libya and fought in the Libyan civil war and clearly was traumatized in one way or the other.
Brian, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. I think the difficulty is trying to ensure. I mean, this is where this is the rub with the democratic process, is how you do things like block British citizens from returning home if you don't have clear evidence that they were fighting. I mean, it's not a crime to go to Libya if you have Libyan origins. And so I think this is the thing that's very difficult for the security services to tease out, and where their job is extremely difficult. And I think they're doing an admirable job, even if the last 3 months have not been their finest hour.
We've only got a few minutes left, and we normally would take a break, but we're going to push through today. I wanted to ask you the election, and we always find it tricky talking about how this is going to impact voting, because we feel when people, as you say, have not been buried, that it's a little bit crass. But we are pressing ahead with the general election. The campaigning is happening today. Sebastian, do you think it will change how people vote?
That's the fascinating thing about this election campaign, isn't it? That some received wisdoms have been thrown aside. I mean, normally, of course, you would say a security matter, a police matter, law and order, conservative. There's no doubt about it. That's the received wisdom. Now we have a prime minister who has been prime minister for a bit less than a year and was the Home Secretary before that. And how that's going to play in people's minds, I'm not predicting particularly, because of course some other received wisdoms have not been true this campaign. Where is the debate on the deficit? You know, this country still has a deficit of 3.6% of GDP. Compare that to all the countries who the British right-wing papers regularly call basket cases, and you will find that they are better off. And I'm not even talking about my own country, which has a surplus. This doesn't happen anymore. The country seems to be tired, seems to have grown tired of austerity, and seems to with that tiredness sort of throw away all consideration about how to finance. And either party's great ideas. I mean, the Labour Party much worse than the Tories, but the Tories are pretty bad in costing the stuff that they want to do.
Brian, we thought this was going to be the Brexit election, and it hasn't really been the Brexit election. We thought it was going to be and then an election about social issues, and now we have security as well. Do you find it, like Sebastian, quite hard to guess how this will impact on voting day on Thursday?
Yeah, well, I think there's two competing impulses, right? So one is when things are going badly, which I think we can agree 3 terrorist attacks in 3 months would be things going badly. There's an anti-incumbent impulse, right? And that's something that will certainly be playing in some voters' minds. Then there's the which party is better on terrorism impulse that Sebastian was alluding to. And I think this is the one where typically, obviously, you'd break towards the Conservatives. But this is where Jeremy Corbyn is trying to play up the first impulse, right, and put this as a police issue and put this as this happened on Theresa May's watch issue and make it not about his credentials in dealing with terrorism. So I think it will move votes. I just don't know how many will be of each type of impulse. And that's really going to be the question that determines, how close the election is on Thursday.
And how important those votes are, because the point that a lot of pollsters are pointing out is that we have an election of 650. Constituencies each it's an election of 650 places, and in the end the Tories will get their majority. I have no doubt about that, because all the worries about that we're talking about in our London bubble, that's in all the Labour constituencies where Labour has a majority of 10 or 12,000 anyway. Then the majority will be 14 or 15,000. Doesn't matter at all. What we're talking about are the marginals in the Midlands and in the North, and from everything I've seen and heard, the Tories will make it.
It feels like the Tories will make it, but we should just point out that Sebastian, it has been an issue that's hit Manchester as well, and maybe unlike in other attacks, this has been felt north and south of the country. So it maybe have a wider impact potentially, do you think?
Yes, I mean, the impact is there, but the problem that people will face on Thursday when they go into the polling booth is, who do I want to be prime minister in Downing Street? Whatever else I think about Theresa May and her abysmal election campaign, I cannot foresee the British people wanting Jeremy Corbyn in Downing Street, and therefore I bet that they will in the end, with very little enthusiasm, maybe a quite a reduced turnout, back Theresa May.
Well, I'm sorry, but that's all we're going to have time for on today's show. Brian Klass and Sebastian Borger, thank you so much for joining us here at Midori House. Today's show was produced by Ben Ryland. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and also by Hanzadeh Achikilain. And our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. More music next, then at 1900 hours, it's Culture with Robert Bound. And we'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. But from me, Andrew Tuck, thank you and goodbye.